Welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Amber Athey, author of The Snowflakes Revolt, How Woke Millennials Hijacked American Media. Amber, welcome to The Bookmonger.
Thank you so much for having me.
Woke millennials hijacking the American media. Isn't this just the 2020s version of liberal media bias? Or, Amber, is this a new phenomenon?
I think this is something different that's happening because this is not a case of people in the media just trending Democrat or tending to be more liberal. What's happening is actually a case of progressives kind of eating their own. At these mainstream media outlets, you have a new class of reporters who have come in who are really just pretty poorly disguised activists. And they've used campus mob tactics to cow their newsroom leaders into pushing coverage further to the left than ever, and also creating a culture of silence for anyone who would dare push back on the idea that journalism should be used for left-wing activism because they're fairly unapologetic about what their goals are. They don't recognize both sidesism, for example. They say that if you recognize both sides of an issue, then you're giving weight to Nazis or transphobia or bigotry, and objectivity is basically just agreeing with whatever left-wing orthodoxy they decide to inject into the reporting that day.
Your book, The Snowflakes Revolt, is full of specific examples of this, but tell us a story. What's a provocative example of how woke millennials have hijacked the American media?
One of the craziest stories that I found out through the course of my reporting for this book was at Politico, and Politico used to be sort of the standard bearer for DC political news, particularly through their Playbook newsletter. But after they had a series of guest writers for Playbook, including Ben Shapiro, which sparked a internal staff revolt, the younger staff there, who tended to be more activist-y, really decided to start going after their colleagues and newsroom leaders to try to push Politico to become a more progressive outlet. And one of the ways that they did that was complaining to editors about perfectly newsworthy articles. There was one by Gabby Orr, and she was writing about the Republican response to transgender ideology impacting youth. So, for example, bills that were being pushed ahead of the midterm elections to make sure that biological men weren't allowed to compete in women's sports. She interviewed a number of different people for this article, including trans activists, but also conservative activists who talked about their efforts to bring this issue to the mainstream. And her colleagues complained to her editors that she had basically published a transphobic article because she had allowed these conservative activists to use phrases like biological men or biological women without Gabby including a specific phrase to let them know, or a specific sentence to let them know, that those terms were deemed offensive. And she was offered sensitivity readers to go through any future articles that she were to write about transgender issues to make sure that she didn't make the same mistake again.
You have a whole chapter on this in The Snowflakes Revolt, and I was surprised to see that during some of these post-article training sessions, somebody objected to the word mother.
There was a training session that happened with a group of transgender activists who basically, their role in being brought into Politico to speak to the newsroom was to impart their vision of what reporters were supposed to say in their articles, ideas of what it means to report on transgender issues. So you basically had left-wing activists who obviously have a very different goal than a reporter telling journalists how to do their job, which on its face is just ridiculous. But some of the things that they said in these meetings was pretty incredible, including that mother might be considered offensive because it's a gendered term. They also claim that reporters should not use phrases like identifies as or biological man because that supposes that a transgender woman, for example, is not actually a woman and is therefore transphobic.
Where are the older and supposedly more mature editors in all this? Shouldn't they be controlling these woke millennials?
You would think so, but unfortunately, a lot of them give into this, and I think there's a couple of different reasons why. And part of the book is making the case that a lot of the tactics being used by the millennials in the newsroom are the same ones that they were using on college campuses to get administrators to agree to take on their pet projects at that time. And the newsroom editors clearly did not learn from those phenomenons. And in fact, they often dismissed what was happening on college campuses as a figment of the right's imagination. So when the woke activists came to their doorstep, they weren't prepared to be able to prevent them from trying to do the same thing in the newsrooms. And the easiest way to prevent these internal revolts is by being the adult in the room and just simply telling them no. But instead, they took on a policy of appeasement where they thought they could get away with turning over one or two things, agreeing to having these activist groups come in, agreeing to update the style guides. And they didn't realize, I think, that this would only lead the woke millennials to ask for more and more concessions and to demand more control of the editorial process.
You have an analysis of all this in The Snowflakes Revolt, but you also tell some personal stories. You've had your own brushes with wokeness, both in college and in the professional media.
That's right. I talk a lot about my college experience because it was very instructive to me for how to understand these issues now that they're taking place in not just the media, but also corporate America and Hollywood and still, of course, higher education. I was a pretty outspoken conservative when I was attending Georgetown University from 2012 to 2016. And I learned pretty quickly that the people who are staging these protests or publicly shaming their companies or their universities to try to get them to enact some kind of political change were not interested in having debates. They weren't interested in the concept of free speech. They weren't interested in understanding the other side. For them, it was all about control and power, and it was really all or nothing. There was no compromise. There was no sense that if someone gave a concession to them that they would be satisfied and they would stop asking for more. It was always trying to take it to the next level. And on a personal level, you know, I whenever I would say anything sort of remotely conservative on social media or on campus, I was always met with a really intense backlash. My freshman year, I tried to start a gun safety organization, and I was reported to my RA for allegedly creating an unsafe environment for the fellow students on my floor because I guess they thought that I was going to shoot up the place or something. I don't really know what the specifics of the complaint were. And then going on in my junior year, I was part of the group that brought Christina Hoff Sommers to speak on campus, which sparked safe spaces and trigger warnings and all of these other things that we typically think about when we think of illiberalism on college campuses.
Does social media contribute to the problem? I'm thinking of its performative aspects and the idea you have to develop your own personal brand rather than be loyal to your media institution, for instance.
I think social media does play a really big role in this because, one, newsrooms never really developed a good policy for how reporters should behave on social media. And so a lot of people did start imparting personal opinions out on Twitter or Facebook or what have you. And it's really hard to put that genie back in the bottle. But they've also used social media in a way to bring public shame upon the companies that they work for. They're using them basically as negative PR tools. And you'll see this when the New York Times reporters who were upset with the Tom Cotton op-ed create a hashtag and they all tweet it at the same time to create a trending topic that makes the New York Times look bad for publishing the Cotton op-ed. And a lot of these older editors don't really understand how social media really works and how these negative shaming campaigns work. And they feel like a dozen people tweeting about something is a really big deal. And so they tend to overreact. It's the same thing with cancel culture when you see corporations and members of corporate boards reacting to cancellation attempts, even though it's typically a very vocal minority of people who are actually upset. And it's because to them, any traffic that's negative on social media is worth responding to. And they do want to appear performatively woke because they think it's going to get them more credibility with a younger group of people, which is typically who they're trying to court for the longevity of the brand.
One more question. You're a survivor of cancel culture. You may have a few scars, Amber, but you have survived it. What advice can you give ordinary people who want to resist cancel culture? What can they do to stop this phenomenon?
The biggest thing that I learned, I survived two cancellation attempts, actually. I mean, probably technically more, but two pretty concrete ones. And the thing that that I regret from the first attempt to cancel me was actually apologizing to the mob, not because it wasn't sincere, but because it wasn't appeasing the people that I was hoping would stop coming after me. And in fact, what happened, I think, is that it only further publicized the incident and made it more serious. In my case, the apology certainly did not stop these people from to destroy my career, my life. A lot of people were messaging my family at the time to try to shame me. The apology led to quite a few news reporters writing it up as a story because I had basically thrown oxygen on the fire. So my advice to people is to not apologize. Now, it's a little bit complicated because if you're an ordinary person who doesn't have a platform and can't defend themselves, sometimes the calculus is a little bit different. But it always bothers me when I see people in conservative media basically giving in to a cancellation attempt and trying to satisfy people who will never be satisfied because they really just want to silence anyone who disagrees with them, regardless of whether or not they've atoned for their sins or if they're sorry or what have you. So that would be my greatest piece of advice is if you stand behind what you said, just because people are offended doesn't mean you have to apologize for it.
The author is Amber Athey. The book is The Snowflakes Revolt, How Woke Millennials Hijacked American Media. Amber, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to all of you for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please take a minute to leave a review. Your reviews help new listeners discover us, and that helps us keep this show going. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.